Okay, Suzanne, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. We're going to be speaking with Suzanne Schiffman tonight on Right on Radio, author of Between a Rock and a Dark Place. You want to start your reading?
Sure. What the? The sheriff slowed his patrol car and strained his eyes to see what his headlights illuminated at the base of a string of mailboxes affixed to wooden poles. A mound, bunched up and blackish. Bare? A contractor's giant-sized garbage bag that took wing out of the back of a pickup? Puzzled, he rolled to a stop several feet behind the strange heap and flipped on his flashers and sidelight beam. It looked like something was covered up or inside some kind of dark canvas. If this is a bear, why would someone cover it up? Illegally hunted, maybe, or hit and killed, an act of empathy? It wasn't big enough to be fully grown. Killing a bear cub wouldn't be something you'd want everyone to know you'd done. Spike checked his rearview, but the ribbon of road behind him disappeared in complete obscurity, threading back into the darkness of the mountains and its hollows. No one on the road at this hour. He hesitated, thinking he might call for backup. If it was just a pile of construction garbage, though, he'd look silly, wouldn't he? If it was a bear, it was more than likely dead, so there wouldn't be any use getting a deputy over here at this time of night. Once he got back to the station to write up his visit to the Plunkets, he'd leave a note for Ronnie Swigert, one of the deputies pulling the early morning shift today in case he missed him. He'd ask him to call MDOT right away, and they'd pick it up, hopefully, before the school buses came by. He checked his gun, but left it in its holster, felt for the flashlight attached to his waistband, and left the patrol car running. God, I hate to see this, he muttered as he pushed open his door and slid his legs around to get out. It took two heave-hoes, but he stood and clicked the door shut quietly. After all, it might not be dead yet, if it was a bear. Poor guy could have been heading up the right-of-way to Ed Marconi's farm to attack his hives and gotten hit or killed somehow. Marconi had been complaining all summer that the bears were getting into his honey and ruining his hives. Since the feds had put a stop to bear poaching in the county and the adjoining park over the past few years, the population had increased dramatically, pushing them down from the mountains in search of food. Now in the fall, they were boosting their intake for winter and getting into people's vegetable patches and garbage cans. Spike shook his head. He'd never been a hunter, believed in live and let live. He knew bears could cause lots of troubles. His neighbor's cherry orchard had been devastated this year by bears. But part of him figured they were here first, so what right had he to disparage the animal? Coons did a lot more damage anyway, digging up Pearl's bulbs, and rabbits managed to get into his garden and eat his lettuce until he spent a small fortune on fencing. He clicked on the flashlight and took a few steps towards the dark shape a few yards away, the shoulder gravel crunching beneath his boots. He began to make out the contours of what looked like a sleeping bag. It was not a canvas or a tarp, but a green, forest green sleeping bag. Laid out, there was something exposed at the top and on one side. Spike edged closer as quietly as he was able. That definitely don't look like fur, he thought as he moved a little closer. Holy, Spike sucked in his breath in surprise and stopped short, his pulse quickening. His eyes were now accustomed to the dark and the contrast with the brightness of the flashlight and spotlight. Protruding from a rip or tear in the side of the bag was a human foot shod in a bright yellow flip-flop. At the far end, the top of a human head was exposed. There was no sign of movement, and Spike feared whoever was inside was probably not alive. Spike's heart was pounding as he backed away, retracing his steps, setting the flashlight on the hood of the patrol car, all the while not taking his eyes off the dark mass. The headlights were trained on the area, and his flashers were on, but Spike felt swallowed up in the dark, black all around him, black like the inside of a burnt skillet, despite the clear and starry night with the waxing moon.
Great. That's Suzanne Schiffman, author of Between a Rock and a Dark Place, a murder mystery that's set in a slightly unknown place in Virginia or Kentucky or someplace like that.
Correct.
Yes. Well, the first thing I want to ask is your first book was not a mystery, and I'm wondering how you decided to go for a mystery this time.
Okay. Well, yes, my first attempted fiction was a coming-of-age love story set in 1969, that seminal year when lots of changes were happening.
Yes.
The Vietnam War, the sexual revolution and everything, and it was just a story of a young woman coming to terms with a difficult love affair and kind of following somebody who didn't love her around the U.S. and into France, and again, there was a Frenchman in that one. But then several people suggested that mysteries are really one of the most popular genres right now, and that perhaps it was time to try something like that. So I did spend a couple of years kind of playing with some ideas, and a couple of things that happened that I had heard about triggered the idea. So that's how it came about.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the story? No spoilers, of course, but just
the
beginning of it.
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, it does. The background is a rural area, kind of backcountry, a backwater kind of place. That's the setting. However, it's not far from a major city, so there is some, you know, travel from people from the city to enjoy the beautiful rural area. So it's not completely cut off from the outside world, but it is a place where, and I explain this in the early part of the book, where a lot of Irish and Welsh immigrants landed, and to, you know, to work the mines and be in the coal business. So they're quite clannish, and they're very close to each other. They stick up for kin, and they're friends, and they kind of tend to stick among themselves, and they live in the hollows. So there's that setting, and then we have glamorous, I guess I should say, urbane French entrepreneur who marries his American girlfriend, and they live in the city, but they take a weekend out in this countryside just for a change of pace, because his new wife finds him a little bit restless being in the States. So they come out for a weekend, and he basically falls in love with it and the beauty, and he sees that there's virtually nothing going on, and he thinks, well, with my sophistication and if the ideas that I have, I could really jazz this place up and bring a lot of people out here. It would really make it quite a destination. And so there's that setting. So he's on his way to buying property, and it goes from there. And kind of a clash of cultures right off the bat.
It's interesting, more than just a typical genre mystery. I feel like you're kind of have a mystery of personality, and people seem to make choices that either are good for them or get them in some trouble. You want to talk a little bit about choice and character?
Yes. Well, of course, the main character, our quote-unquote protagonist, his name is Daniel Perrot, a Frenchman. He's really not the typical protagonist because he's just not liked by anybody in the book. And actually, one of my friends who read the book said, he's just despicable. And I said, well, that's why he's dead, because he's just rubbing everybody the wrong way with his personality. He is a driven man. He has many wonderful characteristics, including wonderful taste and great ideas and charisma. He's very good looking, but he has flaws that he cannot seem to exorcise from himself. And if he had made other decisions on that front and softened his approach, I don't think he would have met the fate that he did. Some of the other characters, I would say all of the suspects that come into play, either they love and hate him. So they sort of have to come to terms with how they're going to deal with him and how they're going to what their approach to him is going to be, based on, you know, which feeling takes charge of the other one. Do they love him enough to forgive his transgressions, or do they hate him enough to kill him, you know, kind of thing.
He seems almost childlike in a bratty kind of way.
He's almost childlike?
In a bratty kind of way.
Yes, oh, he is, and it's interesting you say that, because he comes from a very wealthy family in France. His father has done very well. He worked for his father, so he has this problem in that He really needs to prove himself to his father that he can succeed mm-hmm. away from home, away from his family, away from France, that he can do something that will basically leave his mark on someplace and you know, give him all the attention that he really deserves himself. He's an only child. So, yes, I would say his behavior is extremely childlike, and he has difficulty restraining emotion and restraining, desires, basically. He has tendencies that he simply can't control.
Yes, he doesn't make good choices, which we won't go any further with that because that would be a spoiler.
Correct.
One of the things you do in terms of craft is that you move forward and back. It's like you have sections that are sort of in the now of the book and then sections that are the past. And I'm wondering how you decided to do that and how difficult. Seems like it would be difficult to write the book.
Well, you know, that's why it took so long. I actually had a poster board, and it's, you know, timeline at the top, and then I just had, because it's a 3.5-year time span from basically the beginning of the book to the end. And as you said, it goes back and forward in time as the suspects are interviewed, and each suspect, as he or she is interviewed, recounts their dealings with Danielle Perrault and the interaction and what their relationship was. And what was complicated was making sure that whatever one suspect was relating corresponded to what the other suspect would relate in terms of chronologically, season, time frame, I guess, weather, all of those things. Some things happened that each of the suspects is kind of around for, in a way, and when they're recounting their stories to the sheriff as he interviews them, it kind of had to be, it had to make sense, and it really hopscotches around quite a bit, but some scenes are told again, maybe even three, maybe even four times, but they're told from the different viewpoint of whoever is being interviewed at the time, so... It was a little complicated.
Sounds
and
like
I had
it.
To kind of do a lot of, well, I went through a lot of poster board and started over again. But basically, I went chronologically, and then, of course, flipping back and just making sure that it all kind of eventually meshed together and brought us to the present, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does. How long did it take you to write the book?
Well, the idea came to me with, the idea was triggered by a couple of actual events that happened, which I have completely fictionalized, but that's what inspired it. And I would say those happened many years ago, and I just started to think about them and plan out. I didn't even know who was going to be the culprit ultimately, but I just started to plan out the characters, fictionalized, but some based on composites of people out my way that I know, and they don't know they're in it, but anyway. So that took about a few months, and I'd say the actual writing took place about a year and a half, over mm-hmm. a year and a half, you know, kind of letting it go for a while and then going back to it, talking it out with some people and getting their ideas too. So it was a project.
You talk about poster board, and I assume post-it notes, and which are very expensive, actually. And I'm wondering if you discovered characters as you were writing, or discovered the stories you were writing, or you did do more of an outline kind of a thing to keep it all straight.
Right. Well, the characters I had a lot of fun with, because I think they're all very different and pretty colorful. And, of course, as I said, they're fictionalized versions and composites of people, totally made up. But they just kind of gelled as I got into a scene. I mean, sometimes what is helpful in writing is you just sort of sit at your desk. Fortunately, I have a nice view out my window. You sit at your desk and you just kind of put yourself in the scene that you are trying to create, and somehow you know you want to get some dialogue in there, but you also want a lot of descriptive stuff, and you just sort of kind of put your mind in there, and it just kind of gels. It just kind of comes together, or not, sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it's just a process. I mean, I'm not, John Grisham. I can't just sort of blah, 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 go through
right.
easily and write a whole book in several hours. So it takes a lot of time to just kind of think things through. But once you get into the scene, it's a lot easier, I think. So that's kind of how I do it. Just put myself right in there and think how I would be thinking. And especially the sheriff, he's really stuck himself trying to unravel this whole thing. So he was an interesting character to develop.
Yeah, he's a good guy, I felt like. I enjoyed reading about him.
Sorry, I didn't hear that.
I said he's a good guy. I enjoyed reading about him.
Yes, he's a very good guy, but, having a rough time with this one because there's never been a murder in his jurisdiction, and he's never had to deal with this kind of thing, and he wants to pull out all the stops, and he feels pretty ragged about it, and definitely wants to get to the bottom of it. So and everybody's a little tight-lipped in the country, so he has a little bit of trouble getting people to come forward and talk, basically.
You make sure that the geographical area is kind of anonymous, and I'm
right.
wondering. Personal disclosure: I lived in Whitesburg, Kentucky, for a while,
mm-hmm.
and I was involved with the Apple Shop people. Are you familiar with Apple Shop?
No.
Okay. Well, anyway, I experienced quite a bit of xenophobia. I was the city girl that came down and was going to, change the world in Whitesburg and do kind of what Danielle does, not a restaurant, but in an arts organization and a radio station.
Mm-hmm.
And I experienced a lot of people, like I lived on top of a mountain and a guy said, "Oh, little Missy, I wouldn't live on top of that mountain unless I had a gun and a big dog." And I know, people, it's not that they didn't like me, they were just wary of me. And I'm wondering, how you built that in, because I felt that in the story, how you built that in.
Yes, well, as you say, it's rural and people are suspicious. The people sort of in the region where I'm talking about tend to keep to themselves. They're subsistence farmers mostly, or they do one of the trades. And it's not that they don't talk to people who come into the area, but they look at them with some suspicion. They look at them with, why are you here and what are you going to do? And, of course, I do mention in the book that there are retirees and some wealthier people who settle in this same area, and there's no particular friction. Some people are artists, and they, there's no problem there. They have their thing going on, and some people start some small businesses. There's even a local boy who manages to go to culinary school and start a pretty good restaurant. So there is stuff going on, but the people in the hollers, the clans, they tend not to patronize any of that, and they do look on it with suspicion and just keep to their own ways. And they, with Danielle Perot, there's one scene where he goes into the local sort of Greasy Spoon, the only other little eating place in the area where he's operating, and he wants to buy the newspaper, and the locals are kind of chit-chatting around the coffee pot, and they all sort of notice him and kind of turn his way and turn towards him, and kind of one or two of them nod at him, but the others just sort of, go on about their conversation. So they just, they know he's there, and they want to make sure that he knows that they know he's there. And it would have been fine if he hadn't crossed the line in the way that he does, which is rubbing of people the wrong way, his arrogance towards not using the local construction people, for example, his arrogance in terms of running the restaurant, treating people really cruelly, some of them, and he stiffed some of his local suppliers and all of that stuff. People make note of that, and they don't like it. And things like that happen. But, you know, some people do very well. They come out and settle in and don't ruffle any feathers, and people live happily. But once the line is crossed, there tends to be some bad feeling, and letters are written to the paper and things of that nature. So there's always something that comes up that gets people's dander up, I guess.
Yes, it was one of the reasons I personally enjoyed the book was because of living in an area that's sort of similar to what you're writing about. And mm-hmm. and your character, I assume that you're... Danielle is French because you have a connection with France and the French language.
Right. He is French, yes. He comes from an area called the Dordogne, which specializes in some of the foods that he wants to introduce in his restaurant. And not meaning to stereotype the French by any means, but, of course, when it comes to food and style, the French can get a little bit haughty. I mean, they, especially when it comes to Americans, that they know best, and they have the wherewithal and the savoir faire, I guess you could say, to do nice things and to do it well and do it right. And so there is a certain amount of that in him, but he takes it to the extreme in that nobody can operate the way he does, and some of the foolishness that he thinks is going on, he resents, and he just becomes more and more as bitter and narcissistic as things kind of don't go the way he was hoping, and he feels underappreciated and not appropriately. He wants the glory that he can show his father that he's done something marvelous, and it's not happening, so. He just kind of descends into this, really almost an offensive personality for many. So he just brings a lot on himself, shall we say.
Yes, he does. And that's why you should read the book out there in Radio Land to find out all this good stuff. We're speaking with Suzanne Schiffman, author of Between a Rock and a Dark Place, a mystery that is set in the rural area. What's next for you?
Well, interesting you should ask. I have decided I like writing murder mysteries, so I've got an idea for one that I just started. Its tentative title is After It, so I am thinking about that, and I think it'll be set in the 80s. I don't know if you were alive then, but it'll
yes.
be a kind of a different time period for me.
And how can people get a hold of you? Do you have a website?
I do. It's my name, SuzanneSchiffman.com.
Great. Well, we are out of time here. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Between a Rock and a Dark Place is the name of the book, and it's a great murder mystery, and thank you very much for speaking with us tonight.
Thank you so much.
And now this.
Okay.
Programming is supported by the Ordway, presenting Two Dance. Artistic directors Tony Pierce Sands and Yuri Sands open their 15th anniversary season on the Ordway stage October 27th as part of the Music and Movement series. Tickets and more information at ordway.org.